video calling kiosks, so-called electronic stamps for email communications, extra costs attached to phone money transfers, connecting with loved ones in Florida prisons is changing, and rapidly. But is it just the natural technological expansion of services or an extra tax on families with members who've committed crimes? Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Bank, and for Melissa Ross. We're always live here at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or listen on the WJCT app. Just ahead, Times Union reporter Ben Konark on proposed changes to the Florida Department of Corrections visitation policies. Have a loved one in prison? Have you found it harder or more expensive to keep in touch? Or are you a citizen who believes the new policies are just about protecting against contraband or part of punishment? Whatever the matter, give us a call, 549-2937, 549-2937. Then later, it's Lee Court's Movable Feast in our First Coast Connect book club. Plus, organizers from the Good Luck Have Fun Game Bar are here to tell us about their upcoming fighting game event. All of that and more ahead, but first this hour. Late last month, at a public Florida Department of Corrections meeting, people with friends or loved ones in prisons petitioned officials not to cut the number of visitation hours. The consideration of this new rule follows what Florida DOC says is a spike in contraband, like cell phones, drugs, and other banned materials, making its way into the hands of the incarcerated. At the same time, the department has also been expanding certain electronic services, like video kiosks, at all of its facilities. DOC officials stress that the video calling systems, which require families to either purchase special tablets or to go to a prison facility and chat with loved ones through a screen, are not meant to replace in-person visitation. In fact, one prison official called accusations of that kind conspiracy. Florida Times Union reporter Ben Konark was at the late May meeting in Tallahassee, and he's been following the winding path of possible corrections rules changes since he broke the story about invasive strip searches at a Baker County prison. Those searches focused mainly on women wearing underwire bras because of what DOC considered the relative ease with which contraband could be smuggled in. But a TU analysis found that just 2.5% of contraband that was seized could be directly traced back to visitation areas. Ben joins me now. Welcome.
Good morning.
What are your questions about the proposed changes? How did we get here? We're especially interested in hearing from corrections officers and family members with loved ones who are incarcerated. 549-2937. Again, 549-2937. So, Ben, as I said at the top, it's been quite the winding maze of updates. I think it would be best to concisely start at the beginning.
Sure.
You began covering the DOC at a time when the facilities were cracking down on visitors. What did you initially find?
Yeah, so I started looking at visitation almost a year ago when I first received some tips or one tip from a visitor who told me that these strip searches were taking place. And at that point, all these issues that they were having with visitation were kind of flying beneath the radar, or they weren't mentioning them. Shortly after my story published, they announced their intent to change a rule that would basically allow them to cut visitation in half. That was, I think, early April. And ever since then, it's just been kind of a whirlwind of meetings and organizing and backlash, I think you could call it, to these plans. I think a lot of loved ones feel that this is kind of their only lifeline to the person that they have in a facility run by DOC. So there's a lot of tension, not only with family members and loved ones, but also with inmates inside who tell me, thank you for covering this because this is one of the most important issues for us. Without the ability to hug my wife or see my kids, my life is completely meaningless. So
this is the major implications here for any of these rule changes. We've got some calls starting to come in. We will get to them in just a moment. Again, that number is 549-2937. Corrections officers, retired corrections officers, or people that have previously been incarcerated or families that have members in prison right now, especially, please give us a call, 549-2937. So the crackdown on visitors eventually turned into a proposal to cut visitation, right. Cut visitation hours altogether. But there are a couple of caveats, right?
Sure.
This won't necessarily apply to every facility of past. What are the criteria for prisons that would see visitation hours cut?
Yeah, so there are certain conditions, emergencies relating to contraband, violence, weather conditions, which I think actually weather conditions they already had the ability to cancel visitation for, which we saw after Irma, you know, massive visitation cancellations and evacuations due to that weather issue. But, you know, this is so this is kind of part of the back and forth here where the department says it would only be under these certain conditions and it has to come from the secretary, Julie Jones, or a designee of her. But a lot of the family members and loved ones feel like that designee could be anyone and that they're really concerned about the wardens being in charge of visitation. Mm-hmm. And I think some of that concern stems from wardens maybe, you know, not wanting to deal with visitation a certain weekend and being able to cancel it too easily. Now there's, you know, stuff written into Florida state law that requires visitation to take place. So there's a legal right there, or it is a privilege, but it is codified. It's not a right. So anyway, you know, this basically these conditions are kind of, you know, loved ones would say they're a little too easy to meet, especially given these funding issues and the staff shortfalls. A lot of people are arguing you could apply this condition to just about any facility in the state at any time because we don't have enough guards. So you could always say there aren't enough guards to make visitation happen.
So at the same time, though, your latest reporting on this talks about how DOC in the last 6 months has been kind of expanding the use of of so-called video kiosks and emails. And before we get into directly how this technology works, these video kiosks can be connected to tablets that families have to purchase for $80. On top of that, families can now send emails, but they have to pay a fee for what's called an electronic stamp. Yep. You talk to a lot of family members who are worried that this could someday replace in-person visits altogether. And like I said, we'll get to how this works specifically in a little bit later. But what did they say exactly? What was the worry?
As far as what the loved ones are concerned
about. Right, exactly. I mean, why do they think that this could replace in-person visitation?
Well, because it usually does. And so when video visitation comes to a facility, first of all, they're usually local jails. So we're dealing with a different animal here in Florida where you're talking about state prisons. And we should clarify, which might be obvious to some of your listeners, but jail means you haven't been convicted yet. You're waiting your trial. Prison means you've already been convicted, you've been sentenced, so there's a big difference there. A lot of prisons don't have video visitation. Now, a lot of jails that do have them, and I think you kind of referred to this in your intro, that sometimes people have to drive to the facility in order to use a video visitation, which is kind of a huge hassle, right? Because you're already having to go there where your loved one is, and then you have to use you have to talk to them through a screen anyway. That's not going to be the case in Florida. You can do it remotely from home. It's the loved ones or the friends who initiate the video calling. The inmate can't initiate a video call. And I believe it's about $3 for a 15-minute call. So it's I think, a very kind of narrow video calling system. So I think that a lot of people who are viewing this as a profit incentive are certainly missing part of the picture, which is that the way DOC makes their money on this JPay system is commissions. And they get the commissions every time you put money on an inmate's trust account. Mm-hmm. The families pay for these video calls. So they're not going to, the DOC isn't going to get a commission when someone initiates a video call because their loved one is paying for it directly. What they will get a commission for is the increased use of these services. And that is happening at all facilities now. They're expanding these email kiosks and multimedia tablets to every facility. So the more incentives you have to put money on an inmate's account, the more commissions they're going to see. We've already seen that trend, and we're expecting it to continue to grow.
So we have a lot of calls on the line, so I want to start getting to your calls. First, we have Bob in Atlantic Beach. Bob, you're on the air.
Good morning. I'm a retired federal law enforcement officer, and my experience is with federal prisons, not state prisons. But I want to point out that the families of prisoners typically do not have a lot of spare money. Typically, they're on welfare. Second thing I want to point out is when you dehumanize a prisoner, what you do is harden that prisoner you make that prisoner more willing to commit crimes with less reticence. In other words, what you're doing is you're making a person that when they get out, if they get out, they're going to be a much bigger risk to society. I think that this is a bad idea from the very start. We should be going the other way and encouraging more family interaction to keep the relationship more humanized, more family. And this is even more true when there's children involved.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you for your call. So he's talking about something that I was going to get to in a little bit later in the show, but we can talk about right now, which is the concerns from experts about the effect that this has on prisoners who, unless they're behind bars for the rest of their life, are going to look at someday being on the outside.
Right.
You talked to some experts about what this means for their reintegration into society.
Yeah.
What did they say?
You know, family bonds and outside support networks are the most important thing, according to experts, as far as preventing recidivism. And recidivism is basically the act of reoffending. Doesn't necessarily mean committing another crime. You could violate your probation. It's just something to land you back in prison. So that's a huge issue. I also really like the point that Bob raised about visitation being a way to incentivize good behavior among inmates. So the, you know, when you're in prison, you don't want to lose your visitation, so you're going to behave accordingly, right? You want to still see your loved one at the end of the week. Without that ability to incentivize good behavior, you're pretty much just looking at punitive measures like locking someone up in solitary. So this kind of positive reinforcement is so rare in Florida's prisons. The prisons are so understaffed and underfunded right now. There are so few programs for people to use that one of the major issues right now in Florida prisons is that a lot of people are just sitting around with nothing to do. It leads to drug use. It leads to more violence. It leads to frustrated inmates. So what you're doing when you take away visitation is you're really exacerbating an already kind of volatile situation.
And you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. We're talking about the Department of Corrections and proposed changes to visitation rules at Florida prisons. Please give us a call, 549-2937, especially if you have a family member in prison, have been incarcerated before, or have worked in the DOC system, perhaps as a corrections officer. 549-2937. So let's move back to the company, and you sort of mentioned them already. There's a company here, and they operate, according to your article, in 35 states, and yeah, they do more than just the video calling. They're sort of like the inmates' bank, the banking system. Describe to me what JPay is and how involved they are in Florida prisons.
Sure. So JPay was started in Florida, in Miramar, I believe, and was bought out by a company called Securus in 2015. I think at the time, Securus is one of the three major kind of telecommunications security providers and corrections. The best way to look at JPay is you think about Comcast, right? The way Comcast makes its money is bundling services together. They want you to get TV through them. They want you to get phone through them. They want you to get your internet through them. JPay has the same business model. They're doing banking services in the prisons, but they also want to introduce emailing services. They also want to introduce these multimedia tablets, and they want you to use them for phone calls. And so as these contracts with JPay, as parent company Securus, as they expand, you're getting more of these services in the prison. And the more services you have, the more reason you have to put money on an inmate's account. And the more money that goes onto an inmate's account, the more fees JPay collects and the more commissions the Florida Department of Corrections collects. So what I did was I looked at the commissions that the department brings in every month. I looked back to April 2013, so about a five-year stretch, and found that back then it was like $100,000 a month, and now we're up near $400,000 a month. And the trend, especially in the last few months, is starting to spike. And we'll be continuing to follow those numbers, but you know, what you have basically is as you bring more services into more facilities, you're just getting a lot more movement on these accounts, and that's where the money's coming from.
We're going to go to some more of your calls. Danielle is in Mandarin. Danielle, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My dad was recently incarcerated in jail, and when he called, it asked for a credit card number, and it was going to be $15, and I thought it was a scam and actually hung up on my father. Because I thought it was a scam. And every call after that was $15. And then the video conferencing, we didn't even find out about until later. But the costs are just astronomical for families. And I have a good job, but it's just a challenge on the families. Like, it really, really is. And it feels like they have a monopoly and are just price gouging from a family of an incarcerated person's perspective.
Sure. So it feels like they have a monopoly because they do have a monopoly, because they are the only company that provides these services in the state of Florida for state prisons. So that is, I think you were talking about a local jail and your experience with that. But, you know, in Florida prisons, that is literally the only company you have available for some of these services. So they are pretty much able to charge what they want. Now, a lot of these fee structures are worked into the contracts. So, you know, they're not going to be able to hike them up mid-contract. But contracts can also be amended, as we saw last year in April. They actually, when they expanded the multimedia services.
So, you know, the Danielle's point is well taken, and it is the view that is shared by a lot of families. And she described herself as being part of a family that actually had the means to pay for some of these things.
Right.
And many others, as the corrections officer earlier in the show, or former corrections officer.
I think he said he was federal law enforcement.
Federal law enforcement says.
Watch yourself.
Yeah. And I don't want to demote you. He said, you know, this is something that he has seen throughout his career, was that a lot of people don't have the means to pay for this. However, at the same time, the obvious rebuttal, the DOC and those who are in favor of these types of charges or changes might make, is that not only do they believe that the suppositions that this is a way to get rid of in-person visits are, quote, conspiracies, but they may have a fundamentally different view of what the criminal justice system is supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the age-old question of rehabilitation versus punishment. And they may say, look, it is a burden, and it's supposed to be a burden, this amount of money you're paying. Is this the line that you've heard from DOC officials, or is this something that family members are aware of, that people might think about these complaints?
No, so it's interesting, actually. One of the most interesting things about this whole visitation issue is that DOC agrees with the experts. They say that they totally understand why visitation, and not only visitation, but in-person contact visitation, is vitally important to their inmates, and by way of their inmates, their department and their agency. So there's no disagreement there. I think the viewpoint you articulated, you might run into in Facebook comment sections or the like, right, where you have people saying, hey, you did the time, or you did the crime, you should do the time. And that is traditionally how I think Americans have viewed prisons, as this kind of punitive measure. You did a bad thing and we're going to lock you up. And out of that mentality, we've seen things like mandatory minimums,
mm-hmm.
Where if you steal something worth more than $300, you're going to prison for 3 years no matter what. These are all born of the same mentality, that if we punish people, they're not going to do bad things. I think it's pretty obvious, and the research shows that doesn't work. Deterrence doesn't really work. And what we have now is a bloated prison system, and the third largest prison system in the country.
And that specifically is kind of the broader debate that we're having nationally about for-profit prisons and the differences in approaches to the criminal justice system. But getting back to the specific issues of these technologies and what people in Florida can expect moving forward, as you said before, JPay is already working in 35 other states, and these types of video kiosks already exist in other places. Mm-hmm. Some of them do exist here in Florida, but they're more expansive in other states. DOC is again, to echo what their view is that they believe that there is no credence to the idea that this is to replace in-person visitations. Have you looked at how this technology has been used in other states, and what have you found? I mean, are people's, are families' worries founded or unfounded here?
Sure. So, you know, there's been a study done by a group called the Prison Policy Initiative, and they looked at Sorry, I got a text from Andrew Pintazzi, my colleague, telling me I was wrong about the 300, that it's a felony. All right, I'm sorry, Andrew. There is no mandatory minimum for the felony threshold for stealing. So clarification. Correction, thank you. So your question was about other states, right? So, you know, in jails across the country, there's been a study done, and 75%, I think, was a number that the Prison Policy Initiative landed on as far as jails that then reduce or completely eliminate in-person visitation after they implement video visitation. So that's that piece of it. And I want to get to the answer to the fees issue, where you have loved ones and friends and family members of incarcerated people saying that fees are too high. DOC does have a response to that. It's JPay's response to that. And that is basically, we need to charge these fees because we need to pay for the security infrastructure. We need to monitor all these communications. We need to make sure they're not planning crimes. So that's how they explain the high costs. Now, a lot of people don't buy that. They don't think that it should cost $15 for a 10-minute, 15-minute phone call, because they just don't, you know, they don't see that demanding that kind of funding. But that's DOC's response to that.
All right, we're going to go to some of your calls here. Jason is on the west side. Jason, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks. Great topic. I'll be as brief as I can. My question really revolves around the sort of money-making system that prisons seem to be, especially in this state. And I've had the opportunity to encounter many people over the years, and some of them are close friends. They get out of prison, they have a scarlet letter on them. It's impossible at times for them to get a job. And then not only that, but they're required to pay restitution. Many times that restitution has a compounding interest rate. And so they're kind of stuck in this spot. And then it's so difficult for them. We're asking people to have this tremendous moral fortitude to not go back into selling drugs, to not go back into whatever they were doing before they got them there. And so I guess my question is what are we doing to sort of address that for-profit sort of model that we've got working here, and really reduce the amount of people that are just going to go right back into a life of crime, because we basically made it impossible as a society for them to be reintegrated. Thanks.
Thank you, Jason. What about Jason's point? I mean, he seems to be talking about the broader issues here that we've kind of touched on a little bit already on for-profit prisons,
yeah.
The profit incentive,
right.
And those connections in law to mandatory minimums, which you mentioned.
Yep.
So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, have you looked at that as part of this reporting?
Well, so to the question of what are we doing, we're not doing a whole lot. It's actually getting a little worse now, because there was just a $29 million funding shortfall that led to a slashing of a bunch of rehabilitation programs that are designed to prevent the recidivism from occurring. So things are heading in the wrong direction in that sense. But I also want to get to this issue of, like, and you hear this a lot, that prisons are profit centers, or that prisons make money. At least in Florida, that's not the case. You're talking about a $2.5 billion annual budget. So that is a lot of money. The money that they're bringing in through things like emails and, JPay and labor contracts, which there are quite a few of that I've been looking into as well. These are money saving, right? So by privatizing and, the for-profit introduction through these companies is not making the state of Florida any money. The state of Florida still loses a tremendous amount of money every year to keep this system of mass incarceration going. And I think that's important to recognize. There's no profiteering going on here. It's just a privatization of as many things you can privatize to save as much money as possible.
The company is making JPay is making money.
Yeah, so I was going to get to that next. So JPay, on the other hand, and the company that owns JPay, they won't discuss their financials. They're a private company, but by looking at some of the things that you can measure it by, for instance, valuation of their parent company, I think it was bought for $630 million or so in 2013, is now worth $1.5 billion. So it's more than doubled its value. It's expanded across the country. These services are becoming more and more ubiquitous in corrections facilities across the country. The for-profit companies are making money. The state agency is bringing in a lot of money that it wouldn't otherwise get. But we have to keep in mind what prisons do. And what they do is they lock people in cages and cost taxpayers tons and tons of money.
All right. We've got some more calls to get to. Jillian is in Arlington. Jillian, you're on the air. Jillian?
Hey. Yes, hi, good morning.
Good morning, you're on the air.
Just very quickly, thank you. Very quickly, I have a master's degree, but I was caught up in something false. So I've been in jail for like 4 hours, but I had resources and I was able to bond out. So I have empathy. Kid in my neighborhood got locked up, was in a car with a gun. He had a felony because what? He's been in the street, so he has a record already. At any rate, exorbitantly high bond. They can't pay the bond, so they sit. And so I was putting money on the phone. They charge $2 per day in Duval County to be there, and he had been there within 3 years. So when he got there, they took the money out of his pocket and applied it to that. He was like, I can't get commissary. And he was just, so I was advocating for him. And the lady said, well, it'll be 15% of whatever you give him. So if I put $20 on his book, or 25 basically, he might get, you know, 20. And then they charge you $5, right, to put the money on there. So if I want to give this kid $20, I technically have to have 30. And then the email. So they do have the tablets now. He had to send me an email. They're not, it's called getting out, which is so weird. And so it's 25 cents per email, which is affordable. And I just sent him a scripture to try to keep his spirits up. But when he wants to call me, I put $10 on. It cost me $15, and it's 28 cents per minute. That's the technical rate. And so it's just like, I wonder how much money I've spent. He's been in since March, and they just keep passing his court date, you know, because of bond, and they'll drop the charge one by one. And so when people say it's a new slavery, that's why they say it, because they're holding this kid on a $100,000 bond, and then for him to have interaction with the outside, and his grandmother hasn't had money, and I put money on his grandmother's phone. You know, I'm like, I can't do both. So I'll put money on your grandma's phone so you can talk to her, or now they have tablets. So he can look at sports, because they don't have television anymore. So he's like, can you please put money so I can keep up with my sports? So I'm like, okay, well, we won't talk. Email me. I'll put $20 so you can look at a tablet. So it's really
So you're saying really the cost builds. It's not a whole lot in each specific instance, but after a while of doing this, it can cost a pretty penny. Thank you, Jillian in Arlington, for calling in. So you actually talked about this in your last article about how the fees that are attached to even just sending somebody money for commissary is can be exorbitant for people, especially if they don't have the means. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? What you found with sure. those fees?
Yeah, so there's a sliding 9-tier scale with J-Pay in state prisons, and I think the last caller was referring to a jail, so I'm not sure if the fees are a little different. But basically, you know, you're paying like $2 up to $10, and then $3 from $10 to $20, and then, you know, $5, and it just goes in increments like that. So the more money you're sending, the more fees you pay.
Sort of like Western Union. It's sort of like doing a money order or something right. like that.
But if you look at it right with the argument that DOC uses to say why they need to charge money for the money they do for phone calls or emails, there is no more security argument, right? Because there's no security involved in transferring money onto an account. This is purely to make money. And the other thing, the other side of this is that when you do get money into these accounts, they have one place to spend it as far as physical items, and that's commissary. And the commissary prices are, you can look at the menus, you know, Florida Department of Corrections, to its credit, puts all the menus online, and you can look at the prices yourself and see if you feel they're reasonable. I think some things are fairly reasonable and other things aren't. But, you know, the main thing to keep in mind is, like, a lot of people will view commissary as, well, it's a luxury. But really, from the inmates I've spoken to, you need money to purchase things from commissary. You're going to have a really hard time. You know, I was told we get this tiny little bar of soap that it doesn't last more than a day or two. So if you don't have money to buy soap, you're going to smell bad. If you don't have money to buy other food, you're going to be stuck eating the food that they get, which is, you know, can be very disgusting from what I hear. I've never had it, but so it's, you know, it's a position of desperation that these people are in.
All right. We've got Sam at the beaches. Sam, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm calling from the beaches area. I'm Sam Hall. And the reason I'm calling is because I'm a part of the Neighborhood Accountability Review Board. And what we do is give civil citations to kids before they become 18 rather than giving them a criminal record. Now, State Attorney Melissa Nelson thinks it is a good program. But what are your thoughts about this as a way to towards restorative justice and to save money in the system? That is my question. Thank you.
Thank you. So we have seen an increase of some of these policies that actually keep people out of prison, keep people out of jail. And I'm not entirely sure what the connection might be, but in terms of saving money for the DOC is looking to save money, I guess what Sam is saying, why don't they, you know, put more of their support behind restorative justice that keeps people out of prison than bring them in?
So, you know, we have to remember DOC can't control its inputs, right? They get prisoners sent to them and they don't get to decide who cops arrest or, you know, who prosecutors charge. So it's a little unfair to say DOC should be supporting these kinds of measures. That said, I think it's wonderful that Melissa Nelson has been putting her support behind things like civil citations, and most recently her program about driver's licenses is a fantastic idea. And Sheriff Williams, too, to his credit, also has really increased the use of civil citations as opposed to arresting juveniles. And I think these are really important. I know as personally, if I was held fully accountable for all the things I did before I was 18, I could have very well ended up.
you realize you're on the radio, right?
Hey, that's all right. I think we have to be real about this. I think that we have to be honest about what teenagers do and how in Florida, especially the laws are so strict that without discretion from police, you're looking at an extremely precarious situation for a lot of youth.
So in the small amount of time that we have left here, just over a minute, I want to ask, I mean, what I think the most obvious question here is after reading your article, before you get going, we have to talk about what point in the process we're currently at for these rule changes, and will they officially be voted on soon, and how long does the public have to object or issue any opinions about these policies?
Sure. So right now they are reviewing the latest round of public comment, which is a week or two ago, and they said that can take anywhere from 10 business days to a few weeks. After that, I believe they're going to have to either settle on a rule change, and then I think there may be a chance for people to call for another hearing. It's kind of up in the air at this point, but we'll be following it closely at the TV.
All right. Well, Ben Konark is a reporter covering the criminal justice system for the Florida Times Union. Thanks for joining us today, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Much more still ahead. Later, Stacey Goldring of the First Coast Connect Book Club and Chapter Endnotes talks about her trip to New York's Book Expo. But up next, Lee Court and Movable Feast. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Michelle Corum. It's Tuesday, and tonight at 9 o'clock, we've got Turntable Tuesday right here on WJCT. Music man David Luckin is here to tell us about the show for this evening.
Hi, Michelle. We're spinning a good one tonight. Imagine Rod Serling in a Twilight Zone saying, imagine a band with Freddie Hubbard, Grover Washington, George Benson, Erito, Milt Jackson, Paul Desmond, Hubert Laws, Joe Farrell, Ron Carter, Bob James, and Billy Cobham all in the same band. We've got their music. It's called Giant Box. It was released in 1973 by Don Sebesky. It's on CTI. If you remember those days, you remember what a great album this is. We'll feature the whole thing tonight at 9, only at the Electro Lounge, from Stravinsky to Funk, tonight at 9.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. It's a wedding expo on the road, a luxury party bus for the blushing bride. In today's Movable Feast, our look at dining and hospitality trends around the First Coast. Lee Court of the Women's Food Alliance talks with Kimberly Francoeur of Brides on the Bus.
Banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
What is Brides on the Bus, and what inspired you to do it? Well, Brides on the Bus is a wedding venue tour service provided for brides-to-be. So my inspiration was really to come up with a way to exercise my love of event planning and creating something fun, but that was also a service or a need for a group of people. And I somehow stumbled on the idea of taking a wedding expo on the road where the brides can actually experience the venues and interact with people more intimately than they would at an expo, which can sometimes be a little bit overwhelming. So we invite brides-to-be and their guests onto a luxury party bus, and we drive them to three or four wedding venues in a certain area, and they get to interact with vendors there, like photographers and photo booths or florists, etc. They get to experience catering from one of the venues via brunch or lunch, and also have cake tasting. And also negotiate special discounts and prizes from the venues and the vendors for these brides. And they get to actually see the venues in a way where they wouldn't typically see it on a regular tour because it's already set up like a wedding for this group.
I think that is the ultimate party, just being on the bus. So do you meet in one designated location? Everybody boards at the same time.
Correct.
And it's made by reservation.
Mm-hmm. They book ahead and we meet at one place. I have a little meet and greet and they get special little prize bags that I've prepared for everyone. And we typically will have a brunch first so everyone gets to relax, get to know the other brides and interact with the group.
How many people?
We have a capacity for up to 28, a group of 28.
Okay, so it's not necessarily the engaged girl, and it's one guest or multiple guests that they can bring?
Right, they're welcome to bring the maid of honor or their fiancé, their mom, whoever they feel comfortable with and want to show the venues to and experience it with.
I love this idea.
Thank you.
Can you take our listeners on an exact tour? Start us in one of the locations that you expose to your brides and then walk us through it. What happens?
Sure. Well, last tour, we all met at Hidden Hills Golf Club. Yes. We had a wonderful brunch set up there with a mimosa bar, and everyone got to sit down and talk with each other, enjoying delicious food. We had a donut wall set up by one of the vendors.
A donut wall?
Donut wall, which is very big in weddings right now.
Tell us, we're going to take a little detour right now from the tour. What is a donut wall?
It's a big display. So it's a beautifully arranged display, and this was actually an old armoire that had been converted into this shelf that can hold up to 70 donuts. So just a really eye-grabbing piece in the room. And everyone can take one as a favor in a wedding, typically. It's a little box or favor bags you can take. So brides really like that. And it really worked well in a brunch to incorporate that. Yeah. So it was a beautiful brunch. And after that, the owner of Hidden Hills met with the brides, and she walked them through her facilities and showed her where the ceremonies would be held. The chairs were laid out and arch set up there as if a wedding was
happening.
So they could
see a sample wedding.
Correct.
And then they get back on the bus?
And after that tour, we got on the bus and headed to the second venue, which in that case was the Glass Factory. Big, beautiful industrial space that was also set up
that's
completely
unique.
Right, for a wedding there. We had different vendors there. Someone offering mini cupcakes. A photo booth was set up there for them to participate in. Visited there for about 45 minutes onto the bus and off to the Hyatt downtown.
You have inspired me to want to get married again. Although I'd have to bring my guest, I'd have to bring my husband with me on the bus.
Well, renewals, they're welcome to come on the bus as well.
Renewal of, exactly. Thank you very much. I think I'm going to be joining you for one of the brides on the bus for a renewal. I think that's the ultimate clever. Well, thank you so much for joining me on Movable Feast today. I look forward to seeing your bus on the road and happy brides.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Welcome back. First Coast Connect Book Club blogger Stacy Goldring now joins us. She was recently at New York City's big 2018 Book Expo, and she's here to talk about some of those trends and some summer reading lists.
That's right. Good morning. How you doing, Ryan?
I'm doing great. Well, thanks for being on this morning.
I am so excited that I don't even know if I can even make complete sentences, so I apologize right off the bat.
Oh, that's quite all right.
But you know when you have this thing where it doesn't happen very often, but you have like, there's a thing in psychiatry that my doctor told me about, so you can fill in the blank, called Jerusalem syndrome. And it's when people go to Israel and they go to, obviously, and they go to Jerusalem and then they like go into this state of euphoria that's almost like a mania.
And it carries over even when they leave.
You're looking at me from the book expo. I can't even think straight. I'm so out.
Make sure that our readers can get a good taste of this. Okay. Our listeners can get a good taste of this. Look at listen to me calling them readers. There was a few specific themes that you saw at the book expo.
I did.
So what are some of them?
Okay, so let's talk about those. I want to get them all out, and then whatever we have time for, we can explore, and then people can come find me, call me from coffee, and then we'll go out and talk about it for like 24 hours. I saw a lot of books about activism, addiction and recovery, Korea, quotes, royalty, women, and I'm happy to report that I barely saw any titles with the word girl in it because I'm so sick of that. However, I'm seeing Maid on the horizon. A lot of stuff with Maid. So stay tuned. A lot of books with those types of themes.
Well, and you know, the interesting thing about that, as you know, because you are a book blogger and an avid reader, most of this lines up through a lot of what's happening in current events today.
Yes, yes.
Specifically, the theme of addiction and mental illness, although it has gone without being talked about for a long time. You say sadly because of there's an increasing prevalence because of the opioid crisis. But you saw that as a major theme in the books at the expo.
A lot of books about addiction and
specifically,
and recovery.
You spoke to an author of a book called Drunks. His name's Christopher Finnan. Can you tell me a little bit about his book?
Yeah, this is why I like this book. First of all, let's get on the same page. Addiction is a treatable mental illness, end of story. It has nothing to do with being weak and all that crazy town. So just throw that out the window. So I had an opportunity to speak with Christopher, and he has a very interesting book because it's a historical examination of alcoholism and recovery in our country. So it is nonfiction, and it takes you through historically how we as Americans have approached alcoholism, addiction, and recovery. And our author is in recovery, and I think it's wonderful that he's written this book, and I encourage you, I'm not sure when it comes out or if it's already out, but you can always call your local bookstore, San Marco Books, check with the library, and get on the list. This is an important title, coming for fall, I believe.
You know, I've read some personal memoirs that were nonfiction, sort of creative nonfiction about addiction. I'm specifically thinking about the fame with which Augustine Burroughs experienced after writing some of his memoirs about this specific issue. In the short time that we have left, what makes this one different and stand out?
I think it takes a historical perspective and looks at it very objectively. So we also have books about Korea, which obviously were connected with current events. And Barbara Kingsolver has a new book out called Unsheltered. It comes out October 16th. And I'm telling you, this is something you need to get on the list. You need to pre-order because it takes two families, one in the 1870s, one happening today, turbulent times. They live in the same house, and it explains what happens and how they deal with these issues. And I just want to mention the Great American Reads. If you're looking for summer reading, go to pbs.org and choose your favorite classical or contemporary book to read this summer.
Stacy, as always, thanks for being here. Wish we had more time. We'll be back in a moment. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
UF Health North on Max Leggett Parkway is the region's newest hospital and outpatient medical center, featuring all private rooms, 12 labor and delivery suites, full imaging, surgical services, and 24-hour emergency care. More at north.ufhealthjax.org.
Wait, wait, how old?
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz.
The show is celebrating its 20th anniversary. You know Peter Sagal as its longtime host, but there's more to him than what we hear on air. Peter Sagal on his life beyond Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Paul Schrader, the writer and director of the new film First Reformed, and its star Ethan Hawke, who plays a minister in a spiritual crisis.
Hope and despair. A life without despair is a life without hope. Holding these two ideas in our head is life itself.
There are echoes of Schrader's early film, Taxi Driver. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Hi there, this is Marco Werman in the World's Newsroom. Lots to talk about following the Singapore summit. Our angle, we turn to people who are deeply affected by relations between the U.S. and North Korea. I'm talking about the people of South Korea. We're reaching out to people in Seoul to get their take. And there's lots more, 10 stories that take you around the globe. Join us for the world. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Well, welcome back. Finally this hour, the fighting game. It's been a classic genre of virtual entertainment, from the extremely violent arcade styles of Mortal Kombat to the more cutesy, if a bit chaotic, console classics like Nintendo's Super Smash Bros. All of that is slated for celebration right here at WJCT Studios. Good luck, have fun, gaming bar manager Landon Paul and Brian Ritchie and Ryan Bonifant with Villain Productions are here now to talk more about it. Hey, guys.
What's up? How are you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
So let's talk about what this is specifically. Is this a tournament? Is this something? What's going to be the setup here at WJCT?
Yeah. So basically, what it's going to be is it is a fighting game tournament that's going to feature a bunch of the current fighting games that are really popular with the video game community in that regard. But it's also some other things that we're going to have as well taking place this weekend with an artist gallery, some local vendors that's coming to share some of their product that they're going to be having and stuff like that. So it's a fighting game tournament, but we're making it to where like there's going to be a little something for everybody, not just for the competitors that are going to be playing in this event this weekend, but also for the casuals that just enjoy the gaming culture in general is what this is.
So Landon, this is, I believe the event is itself is called Revival, right?
Yeah.
And so it had me thinking as a person who I'm more of a casual gamer now. I used to be more into actual gaming, more console gaming, and even some PC mm-hmm. gaming. But the fighting game is like one of the like foundational classics to video gaming. When I'm thinking Absolutely. About I'm thinking about playing it like on my Super Nintendo and stuff yeah. like that, Mortal Kombat and stuff like that. But why is it called Revival? Is it because that style of game just isn't played as much anymore, or?
Well, as far as the name Revival is concerned, I'll kick that answer actually right on over to Brian. Okay. He came up with that name.
So. All right, yeah.
So Ryan and myself, we've been with the fighting game community for a long time, and then we had a period of time when it started to dissipate. You mm-hmm. know, a lot of the competitions and the community effort involved with that just kind of just went downhill. So we decided, hey, you know, let's come up with a concept of something, you know, an event to where we can get everybody back. And, you know, with us starting all this, we were like, hey, you know, a good name, let's call it the Revival, you know, mm-hmm. and just kind of revive the community. So
what games are going to be ready for people to play or are going to be part of this tournament this Saturday?
Well, what's really cool about this event, we're actually bringing in the Smash community. And so all the Smash kids will be there. We're going to have Street Fighter V, Tekken 7, Dragon Ball FighterZ, Street Fighter 2 Turbo, so that's one of the old classics. We're doing singles and doubles with the Smash players. So it's really a lot of games.
I think in total we're running about 11 tournaments in total in this. And it's the cool thing with fighting games because it's an individual, you know, 1v1. It's not like a team team right. battle like you would see right. like in League of Legends, see like that, where those games could take forever.
Right.
So it's a 1v1 atmosphere, offline, just set up the system to a monitor and just play and just go and everything. So these games can go fairly quick and the tournaments themselves can go pretty fast. So, you know, and it also depends on how many entrants that you get per tournament and everything as well. That affects how long an event could go. But you can basically run this type of event that we're doing anyway, which has been like a monthly series, at least for the day.
So how many of these games are available to people to play on a regular basis at the game bar, which is at the Landing, by the way?
Oh, yeah. All of them for sure. We do, because of the fact that, you know, we obviously on a monthly basis host this series at GLHF, it's one of those situations where we are directly, you know, involved in the fighting game community specifically. So we make sure that we keep all the stuff that's kind of in that sort of demand for that demographic, you know, fully playable in multiple different facets. So we have, you know, console gaming. We hold a weekly there. A lot of the guys that show up for our monthly series tournaments show up for like a more casual weekly meetup kind of community thing. And then also, I mean, we have old fighting game cabinets and stuff like that that people play that are in great condition. Some of my favorite things to play up there are those. But yeah, we as a company itself, outside of, you know, our relationships with, you know, other networking and stuff like that, we try to be very focused with the fighting game community. It's a very strong scene in Jacksonville, and it's something that we wanted to you know, help grow ourselves, and not to mention, you know, my role in the company and then my huge passion for fighting games myself.
Right.
So
nice. Brian, excuse me. There are too many
Ryans
and Brians on this table right now. Tell me a little bit about the logistics or the specifics for this Saturday. Is this the first time that you've had this here at WJCT? When should people show up? How can they be a part of this?
So this coming Saturday, the Smash starts at 12 o'clock.
Okay.
And then goes from there. So 1 o'clock, Street Fighter 2 Turbo, and then so on. But I mean, we expect people to arrive around 10 o'clock and going from there. You know, it sort of starts to trickle in as the other games and all the participation, you know, all the people that want to play their certain game, you know, they start to trickle in. So
sure. Well, thanks, guys, for coming on and talking about this. And my last parting thought is Melee is better than Brawl and always will be. And
we'll have Melee Revival. Yeah. It'll be available Saturday. Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. We'll be right back tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.